Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman. My colleague Stu Mandel is off this week. He's taken a little bit of a vacation, but we have a really good guest today to fill in for Stu. And he is Neil Brown, the head coach at West Virginia, who is a very thoughtful coach on a lot of subjects. And I thought it'd be interesting to get Neil's perspective on a lot of what has been going on for the past couple of months. Neil, thanks for joining us on The Audible today.
Bruce, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, I thought it'd be fun. Stu's on vacation this week, or at least he's on home vacation. And
staycation.
I thought we'd have... Yeah. I mean, whatever it is to decompress for a minute. So let's start there. Like, so obviously you're working, but it's a different environment. What has the last couple of months been like for you?
Zoom. Trying to manage people remotely. It's been unique. It's been challenging. I think I've grown a lot of ways. I think I've probably grown in a lot of ways. But it's been different. I think that's a simple word, but it's the best, probably the best word I can use to describe it. It's been different.
So when you're in the middle of this, and you're obviously a leader of a program with a lot of people, not just players, but staff and people you report to, like, what has been the hardest thing for you to sort out as you're in? We're all in uncharted waters, but as a football coach, you certainly are too. So what's been the hardest thing to kind of figure out?
Communication has been vital during this. I think there's a fine line between doing enough and then overdoing it. And I think that walk that fine line, and that's something that we have a plan that we've in place. We've adjusted it as we've gone. It's really been centered around three things, Bruce. And the first one's been the health and wellness of our players and our staff. And one of the main ways that we've done that is to try to have check-ins Monday through Friday with our players, whether it's position meetings, team meetings. We try to have daily check-ins and really check in on their physical and their mental health and those within their family as well. The second thing is just trying to develop routines and schedules. I think those are so important during this time, is developing a routine and a schedule, because there's so much literature and so much research that's done. If you stay on a routine and schedule, then you can manage yourself much better. And the third thing is just trying to maintain this culture of accountability. What I mean by that is as coaches, we can't hold them accountable to their workouts. We can hold them accountable to their position work and things like in academics and things like that. When I say position, from a meeting standpoint, but they really have to hold each other accountable for working out and staying in shape. So those are the three things: health and wellness, routine schedule, and then a culture of accountability. That's been our really focus during this entire 11 weeks that we've been in quarantine now.
I've talked to some coaches, not just head coaches, but assistants, and they said, you know, for them, some of them have watched more TV news than they probably ever have, because there's been a lot more downtime. It's not to say that there hasn't been a lot of busy work, but also the routine is different. Has there been some things that you have found that you've either, I don't want to say gotten into, but just have been things that have kind of something you've started to think about a lot more away from football, that is something that, you know, we're in a pandemic and you're just kind of thinking, it just takes you in a different place mentally. Is that something you found from your own perspective?
Yeah, I think that's a really good view. Is it takes a lot of different things into consideration. And so I think there has to be a good mix of, it can't be all work right now. You know, I think that I pose this question to our staff and our players is, when we look back on this, outside the tragedy of this, that this is, and the people that have lost their lives and the people that are lost their livelihoods and the people that have gotten sick, after that, like, how are you going to remember this time in your life? Is it a point of growth for you, or is it an excuse for you? And so we really tried to, and myself included, really tried to make it a point of growth. I've probably watched more actual football film than I ever have during this time of year, because I've had the ability to do that. I've probably had more conversations with recruits, more in-depth conversations with recruits and their parents than I ever have, due to the restrictions that we're under, because they can't come in to the facility or on our campus. I like to read. We've had that discussion before, Bruce. Mm-hmm. But I've read more. I've talked to more coaches than I probably have since I've been a head coach over the last 5.5, 6 years. So there has been some real growth for me. Television-wise, like The Last Dance. Somebody asked me about The Last Dance not too long ago, and I grew up in, like, Michael Jordan, so I appreciate him and the type of competitor he was and those Bulls teams. I grew up, and I'm from Kentucky, so you know I like basketball. And, mm-hmm. But it really was such a nostalgic look back, because, you know, I'm a senior in high school, and I graduated in 98. And so, like, the music, the dress, all that kind of stuff was such a cool kind of flashback. So I've enjoyed that. So there's been some things that my kids are 12, 9, and 5. And this time that we've been able to spend with them, and, you know, it's like fun. It's, you know, here I am coaching at the Power 5 level, great athletes, and I'm having to bring my wife in to translate how to get my 5-year-old son to, I know how I want to teach him to hit the ball off the tee, but she's having to translate because she's got elementary school education degree.
Yeah. I think what's been interesting, just from, you know, I can relate to having young kids. We have two kindergartners, and the one thing I've taken from this and tried to remind myself of it is, I've always heard, and especially now, you probably a difference between your oldest and your youngest, but I've always heard from some other parents, when your child becomes 11, 12, 13, they're probably not going to want to spend as much time around you as they did when they were 4, 5, 6, 7. And so what I've tried to remember is, hey, we're going to wish at some point, probably not too far in the distant future, that we had savored more time when they were that age. Well, now's our opportunity. You know, we're around them all the time. And especially, you know, I'm not saying I travel more or less than the average person, but I know what it's like in the football season. And I know there's a lot of time I spend on the phone for work and whatnot. It's like, and I'm not saying I'm not doing some work now, but you know, it is things that I think I will appreciate more for that time that I have with our kids, especially. But the development piece to me is interesting, because I've heard this from talking to other coaches, and you alluded to this before. You are a voracious reader. I remember you were telling me, for a story we did when you were at Troy, that your mom was a librarian, and that probably had a big role in that. And what are the kinds of things you've been reading this off season? Has it been strictly for development, or has some of it been for maybe to kind of decompress a little bit at the same time?
Both. I read, it was in my mom's elementary school librarian. We've talked about that before, Bruce, but I read now because I'm curious as much as anything. And I read because I want to grow, but also want to be able to take that knowledge that I'm getting and be able to put it into our staff and our players, because I realize that everybody's not into reading. And so I think it's an avenue that I can use to maybe help pour into our guys, whether it's our staff or our players. And so I've got I'm all over the place. I don't know how you do it. But I read multiple things at once, and then I go back and here's a good example. There's a book by Ryan Holiday, The Obstacle is the Way. Well, I read that a couple of years ago, but I got it out at the start of the pandemic, because what better book to pull from than that? You know, the whole premise of it is turning tragedy into triumph. Well, you were in the midst of a tragedy right here. How can our program triumph out of it? How can we come out of it with an edge? I read a book by James Clear called Atomic Habits, because I'm intrigued by people that have extreme discipline. I finished some, is Lombardi doing some things for The Athletic now?
He is. Yes. He's a columnist.
So I'll pump The Athletic. I read Lombardi. I finished Lombardi's book. I'm reading a couple of books on teamwork, because I think that's, and here's the other thing too, is I've been a part of some leadership development seminars that have been tied in with the military through Horizon Performance. And those have been awesome, and just talking with topic, listening to some of the military leaders that lead special forces, and, how do they manage in times of crisis? How do they make intangible behaviors? How do they measure those? It's been really interesting just to have some conversations with people that without this ever occurring, there's no way that I would have made time. There's no way I would have been, because I've got my calendar and I forgot to erase it all. So I'm constantly reminded on what I would be doing if the pandemic wasn't going on. And so, between the booster functions and caravans and Big 12 meetings and those things like that, I wouldn't have had the time to not only spend time with my family, but also spend time in personal growth or just in engaging with people that can help build our program.
How mindful do you find you have to be as a head coach? And you're certainly, and this fits as the head coach at West Virginia, where you're one of the most visible people in the state, where you know that the coaches you go up against are all, it's a competitive business. Everybody is all trying to get an edge. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who are going to say, whoever comes out of this the most prepared will have the biggest advantage come the fall. How do you manage messaging that in such a competitive business, while also trying to be mindful that there are people, there's been a lot of loss of life, and there's a lot of people who are scared and concerned. Maybe it's hit their families. Certainly, maybe it's impacted their jobs. And so how do you kind of find the balance there with, I know what I need to do, but I also know that I have to be cautious, maybe that things either aren't taken the wrong way or misinterpreted.
Well, football is not the most important thing. And I talked to our players about this, and this is something we've really probably spent more time during this, is I'm a football coach, but that doesn't need to define who I am. Our guys on our team play football, but that doesn't need to define who they are. And so we've tried to make this all about our players as individuals, and not about getting better as a football player or getting better so we can have a successful season. Because it has, football has taken a back seat to this. I'm looking forward to the day when we can be together as a football team. Is we can teach, we can share personal moments. I'm not sitting here missing the wins. Now, listen, I love to win. That's part of it. But I'm missing the personal interactions. I'm missing the opportunity to see growth in our players. And so I think you make decisions that with the players in mind. My biggest concern during this pandemic for our football team has not necessarily been about the physical health. I've been more concerned about the mental health side of it. And just because early on during this pandemic, I was watching all the news channels. I was trying to keep up with everything I possibly could. And I just couldn't I wasn't intelligent enough in the science realm to understand what was political, what wasn't political, what numbers were accurate, what weren't. So all I know is this is bad. It's serious. I've done exactly what our people have said to do. And as we've gone through this, all right, I've learned that at our age bracket, now there are exceptions, just like there's exceptions to everything, but the age bracket that we coach is, for the most part, hasn't been as severely affected as some of the other age populations. And so when that became, you know, I started worrying more about their mental health. And the reason being is because so many of these guys that we coach, is everything in their life's been turned upside down. They're creatures of routine. And as a Division I athlete, you're always focused on what's next. So you go through your winter conditioning, then you have spring ball, and then you have time off in May, and then you have 8 weeks of summer, and then you have a little bit of time off, then you have fall camp, and you get what I'm saying. Everything rolls through. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, in basically, you know, a 24 to 48-hour period, is everything was disrupted for them. And some of these guys were thrown back into their home situations that just weren't very good. And they're having to deal with things that they either never have had to deal with, or they're dealing with things that they overcame, and now they're having to deal with them again. So we've been really mindful of our players' mental health. And that has been my biggest concern. That's why I'm looking forward to getting our guys back on campus and creating a more normal routine, and where we have tools here that can help combat any negative mental health situation.
Back to the podcast in a minute, but first, a word from our newest partner, Hydrant. Top performers in business and sports often attribute their success to their morning routine, whether it's waking up early, setting their goals for the day, exercise, or meditation, but not everyone has the time to do it all. With Hydrant, you can jumpstart your mornings. Hydrant creates flavored electrolyte packets you mix directly into your water to make hydrating your body easy and delicious. And Hydrant is backed by research. The formula was developed by Oxford scientists to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. There's no synthetic colors or artificial sweeteners. The formula is vegan, and you can choose between three different flavors or a variety pack. Hydrant starts at just $1 a packet for a 30-day supply. You can save even more with a monthly subscription. So get 25% off your first order by going to drinkhydrant.com/audible. That's drinkhydrant.com/audible for 25% off your first order. drinkhydrant.com/audible. Now, back to the podcast.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to what you said at the beginning too about, I felt like there's a overload or overwhelming quality you would get if you watched a lot of the news.
Yeah.
And the thing that is exhausting to me, and I got to be on social media to some extent because it goes with the job, but it's like everything feels like has a political, you know, tie to it in some capacity. You know, it's like, okay, there's this story, and I'm like, don't look at the comments underneath it, because it's like, it's like,
I agree.
It's just an overwhelming, exhausting quality. Where I'd like to think that the majority of people who are out there are not doing, you know, everything from an agenda. Either it's one side or the other. You know, and it's tiring. It's just, you know, it is. And I felt like once I was like, all right, I may turn on the TV, and it's, you use the word when you're talking about The Last Dance, and it was a great word, is nostalgic. Like, I have watched a lot of old sports or things that kind of put me in a more settled frame of mind than I'm going to turn on and watch some press conference or hear people shouting at each other about things.
I agree.
I don't know it's just tiring now.
I'll tell you, I was working out, Bruce. So I was working out in the morning. That's one thing I've gotten a much better routine is since this all started, is I was working out, and what I was doing, I was bouncing back and forth every morning. This is probably the first 3 weeks maybe of this, of I would watch Fox News and then I'd watch CNN, and I'd bounce back and forth. And then it became so, it was like I was living in two different countries. And so, and I was trying to read all the stuff on Twitter and other online things where I was trying to keep up with every breaking detail. And I just got in a funk and I could feel myself. And it's like, you know, sometimes you read things and you think, man, I just read this and it hit me at the perfect time. Well, Trevor Moad's got that book, It Takes, mm-hmm. which Andy, you know, who I really like, wrote with him. And there's in there, there's a part of that book, it's just talks about removing the negative. And like, I removed all that from, and then I started getting all my information directly from Clay Marsh, who's kind of taking he works for WVU Medicine, and he's taking the lead in the state of West Virginia. And the state of West Virginia has done a good job for the most part with this. And I started getting all my information from him. And once I removed all the extreme views, like my outlook and how we were approaching that was so much better.
Yeah, it's funny. I wasn't when you said that, something stuck with me. So about a year ago, I don't know if this is a conversation I should go into, but about a year ago, I remember there was some sports talk seminar that I was speaking on with Steve Weich and Ramona Shelburne. We were on the same panel. Right before us, and our friend Chris Vanini would perk up with this name I'm about to throw out. But right before us, there was a panel, or just, I don't know if it was a panel, it was just a segment that was done by Eric Bischoff, who was a big WCW, like I think he ran it for Turner in the 90s, before, you know, when they were going head-to-head with mm-hmm. Vince McMahon. And this is, again, it's a year ago, and he said something that he talked about, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically what they were really good at with carrying their storylines over was like this adrenaline fix. And he said that what these news shows now are really designed to do is to get you angry and to get you to come back. And it's almost like, you know, you can imagine like this being like a lab experiment or whatever that you're kind of sucked into. And it's a little maddening to hear that, but it's definitely exhausting to get sucked into that. And I referenced talking to it was a defensive coordinator who's a little older, probably about a month and a half ago. And he was talking about the first time he'd ever watched the news. And you could tell he was engaged, but I'm not sure in the end how healthy it was probably for him, you know? And I think that's a lot of people. And it's, you know, whether what other side, regardless of what side of political views you hold, it's just, it can be exhausting and you get worked up. And I think when you know, you talked about the mental health of your players and everything, I think that, you know, I think it can be not just for the players. I think it can be just for, you know, whether you're an 18-year-old who's still trying to figure out who you are, or you're a 38-year-old or a 48-year-old and you don't know where this thing is going to go, you know, from a health standpoint, from an economic standpoint. I think we're on uncharted waters with this.
Without question. And we don't know what we don't know. You know, like my wife had a very good point the other day. Our kids were getting into the swimming pool. And I said, you think we're good on this? And she said, I don't know. And that's the point. Nobody knows. Because mm-hmm. when you're dealing with something, it's a novel coronavirus. You know, and that very word novel means it's new. And so we don't know. I think we're so concerned about what's right and what's wrong. I just think we have to protect the people. The people in decision-making have to do the best we can with the information that's available. And honestly, and we're going to make some mistakes on it, but that's all we're trying to do right now is we're trying to do the best we can with what we have available.
Yeah, one of the things I've seen some people say as well, you know, they'll talk about, you know, Anthony Fauci or this person or that person and say, well, they were wrong on this. And it's like, well, these aren't weather forecasts where it's like, you know, whatever you, Neil, whatever you and I do is not going to affect whether it's going to be a tornado in Morgantown or a rainy day in LA. You know, we go outside, we do it. It's like whatever people do cannot affect whether it's going to snow or not. But some of these other things, it's a virus. It's a different thing, you know? So I think it's one of these things where it's, you know, it's a changing thing. And I just think we, you know, it's great to be optimistic. And I think that's important. And just try to be as smart as we can. But yeah, like you said, I mean, I think it's great that you have a resource like you have where you can trust it, as opposed to these other things that you're like, okay, I don't know if, you know, who's saying this or what the spin behind it is. Because if you really get, you know, end up, you know, kind of living that way, it's like, what are you going to believe? You know? And it's just like, you can be just twisted upside down with it. One thing I was curious about, and you mentioned this before, when we're talking about players and 18 to 22 year olds, obviously the statistics indicated is very low risk in terms of this. From talking to some coaches around the country, one thing that was brought up to me was, well, there's some older guys on staffs, or maybe they're not in really good shape and they're also older. How much do you think that is a concern from what you've talked to either some of the coaches, you know, maybe not necessarily in Morgantown, but at other places where it's like, yeah, the players are one thing, but you're also going to be around a lot of assistant coaches who may not be, who may be more at risk.
Yeah, I think that's I think it's something we have to take into consideration. And so, you know, we're going to be really careful with how we bring our staff back to the office. I found that we can be really productive without being in the office all the time. Now there's some definite negatives to it, and it's hard, the communication's harder. The video and operating the video equipment's what's the biggest hindrance in my opinion. But you have to take into effect that. So, the precautions that we're going to use are all what we call best practices. That I think the Big 12 was proactive. They partnered up with Dicon out of Duke University, and I think the NFL may be using them as well. And then our medical community here has been really proactive. So we're going to use best practices, and those best practices are really put into effect to protect those who are at most risk. And so, you know, I think that, you know, everybody talks about we're going back to normal. I don't know if we'll ever go back and it be the same as it was last fall, or maybe even the end of February. I don't know if we go back to that. And I always reference back to 9/11. If you can remember flying before 9/11 and then flying after 9/11, significant difference and reasonably mm-hmm. so. And I think it's going to be similar with how we operate. And so – but I do, we have to make decisions with those most at risk. I think with those in mind, and we definitely are here. And I would say most across college football are doing the same.
How concerned would you be if you guys have a certain either protocols in place and you're playing a non-conference team that may have very different protocols? You think that'll be an issue for some teams if they look and say, well, our teams have tested X amount of times and this other team hasn't tested at all and our player is going to be playing them? Do you foresee that could be some issues coming up at some point down the road, not too far down the road?
I think that there's going to be a lot of questions like that, Bruce, that I don't have an answer for right now. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that's been kind of scary, but it's, you know, the unknowns are so real. And as a person that's in a leadership position and a person that's responsible for a program and a lot of people under that, it's unnerving to sit there and say, I don't know. And I've probably said those three words more here in the last 3-4 months than I can ever remember. I don't know. I don't know how we're going to deal with some of these things. One of the things I think that we can be prudent about is a decision like that doesn't really need to be made until closer to the season. You know, so here at the end of May, I don't know if we necessarily need to make decisions about something that's going to happen in September. Because if we continue to wait, the more we're going to have more information, and the more information allows you to make better decisions. And so that's been really one of kind of my pet peeves during the show is it's okay to wait and make a decision. You know, people are getting such a hurry to make decisions. And to me, it's like, let's just wait. You know, there's certain deadlines we'll have to meet as far as making decisions, but let's get closer where we have more information, more data, and then we can make more educated decisions. So in that case, I think we need to get to August before we make some of those decisions, because I think we'll have information for that. And so I was thinking, I don't have enough information right now. I'm not trying to dodge it. I just simply don't know how we're going to handle some of those situations right now.
Yeah, I think in my line of work, I think it's often kind of frowned upon if it's not great TV or it's not, you know, if it feels like it's not decisive. So you'll see a lot of times people on TV or talking heads who will say some things that are, you know, cocksure and really colorful or whatnot. They could be way off base, but they're going to, you know, it's like, I don't know, is something that usually people who are in the media are reluctant to go there, because I think in their heads they feel like that's not part of their job, when in reality it's probably the most honest thing they could be. And the flip side of it is, I think what you just articulated, especially in as football coaches, where, you know, so many are, you have to lead 100 people, 100 plus people. And if you don't seem like you have all the answers, or aren't totally sure, and we know plenty of people who are probably marching through this without any hesitation, when probably they should have at least a little hesitation, right? And I think that's, you know, I think it's, honestly, I think it's refreshing to hear somebody answer that, because as we've said, it is uncharted waters right now.
Well, I think it's important. I think if in any leadership, it's really important to be vulnerable. And because I've never met anybody that doesn't have all the answers. And so I think you lose credibility if you make decisions without having knowledge. And that's why I've been quick to really lean on our medical people, whether it's our athletic trainer or our director of medicine or people in the hospital here at WB Medicine, because they're much more educated on how to handle those situations. Now, I'm not asking them what to tell to run on third and medium. You know what I mean? But because I have more knowledge, I should be able to handle that better than they do. But when it becomes, you know, how do we handle bringing guys back onto campus? What best practices should we use? Should we wear a mask? What kind of hand sanitizer? What are, you know, all those things? They need to do that. And when they say, hey, Neil, we need to wait before – we need to get more data. We need to get more information before we make decisions. And I'm listening to them. And then I'm becoming more comfortable standing in front – like I told our guys on – I guess it was yesterday or Tuesday. I said, hey, the Big 12 said that we can have workouts beginning on June 15th. I said, to do that, you need to be back in town June 10th. It's voluntary. It's not mandatory. It's up to you. And I said, we're going to have precautions and best practices that we're going to make it as safe as we possibly can. Is it going to be 100% that I can't guarantee anybody anything, but we're going to do the best we can. And I said, when we get closer to that date, I'm not sitting going to tell you what every precaution we're making right now is, because we may get more data. But before you leave to come back here for June 10th, I'll let you know exactly what to expect and what our procedures are going to be. But I'm not going to do that until it's closer to it.
One of the things, the last thing I wanted to broach with you is, and this is something that really has come up in the middle of the pandemic, which was the NIL rule with college athletics has shifted. And I noticed a few weeks ago, you guys had hired Jeremy Darlow as part of, I think he's as part of your fifth quarter program, right? He's a brand marketing expert and consultant. So tell me how you envision that.
I got into this profession for two reasons when I was really young. And the first one was, is I wanted to be around young people. The second was I love the schematic challenges of offensive football. But as I've grown and matured, especially as a head coach, I really kind of view this game as a way to develop young people and not only develop them, their on-the-field performance, but their off-the-field performance. And I'm really intrigued by how we can continue to get better at doing that. So we've developed this fifth quarter program, and as part of that is there's a branding initiative that we partner with Jeremy Darlow on. And I've always felt like since social media has grown in significance, that the branding aspect of social media is huge. And in your personal brand and telling your story is something that's going to be critical regardless of what profession you're in. Whether you want to be an NFL player, a doctor, a financial advisor, whatever it is you want to be, telling your story and promoting your brand is going to be critical. And so I read Jeremy's book, Brands Win Championships. And then we had some dialogue after that because I thought there were some real truths in it and really some things that help build programs. And then he sent me the advance for Athletes or Brands Too. And I read that and I was able to do a quote for the forward of his book. And it just resonated with me. And we had more dialogue about, man, this could be a great teaching tool. And then at the start of the pandemic, we kind of got back together and he offered up this service. And what I really like about this is it's a service for our student athletes. It's not mandatory. It's something that they can choose to do or choose not to do. But if they choose to do it, I really think that they're going to grow and it's going to help them. Not only people are looking at it, that is an NIL-based deal. To me, that's not. It's really about setting themselves up post-career-wise. Now, we're gonna do a deal with a group called Influencer that's more NIL related. But I think with NIL, and this it's a hot topic, and it's to me, it's not if it's going to go through, it's when it's going to go through. And I think you either embrace it or you complain about it. And so either one of them is going to be the same result. So we've chosen to embrace it and try to educate our players.
Interesting. I think it's going to be interesting to see how other schools try to make that piece work and what they do with it. I've seen your arch rival Pitt. Looks like they've done something with Jeremy too as well, right?
Yeah, then and that's I saw that, and he's going to partner, I think, with. I don't know. He's got a plan, but to me, it's not. I don't look at it as. It's competition, getting it, and all that kind of stuff. All I'm looking at is, all right, how can we make our players better? If Pitt has it, Georgia Tech has it, hey, so what? That's not something that we did for a recruiting purpose. It's something we did because I thought if our players could go through the course and they were going to learn from a branding expert, you know, if anytime you can bring an expert in a field that you think is going to benefit your players or your staff, you want to do that. So here we had an opportunity to partner with an expert in their field that could teach better than I can teach on the importance of branding, all right, and your personal brand and how to set yourself up. So that was the thought process behind doing it. But it is going to be interesting. The NIL is going to be interesting. I think there has to be more clear legislation on exactly how it's going to be enforced, what are the parameters. I think those – it's going to happen in my opinion, but I don't know exactly what it looks like just yet. Mm.
All right, Neil. Well, I appreciate your time and your patience with the internet connection we had. It actually was much better on the one that you thought might be spotty. That one came through really well. All right. Well, I look forward to seeing you in the fall this season at some point. And, hopefully everything keeps going in the right direction.
Well, I appreciate it.
Okay, before we get back to the podcast, smelling good is important. Man, I can't tell you how many times Stu has brought that up on one of our calls. It's a big thing about him. It's a big thing I know about a lot of our listeners. And Hawthorne, our latest sponsor, smells really good. Getting Hawthorne cologne is so easy. Just take a quick 2-minute quiz and Hawthorne tells you the two colognes that are best for you. One for work, one for play. It's totally risk-free with free shipping and free returns. Check out Hawthorne at hawthorne.co. That's H-A-W-T-H-O-R-N-E. That's right, with an E, .co, not .com. And use my promo code Audible to get 10% off your first purchase. That's hawthorne.co. And use our promo code Audible to get 10% off your first purchase. Stay tuned for The Athletic's Seth Davis, who sits down with SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey, who has some very interesting thoughts as college football ramps up on the way back.
The Southeastern Conference took a major step last week when it announced that its schools can begin welcoming athletes back onto campus for workouts beginning on June the 8th. But is the SEC really prepared to do enough testing to make sure that its athletes are safe?
It's really important that we not assume that a set of conference guidelines are actually all that will be done on our campuses.
That is SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey, and he joins me today to discuss how the league arrived at its plans, how it will execute those plans, and what the path looks like moving forward, hopefully, to getting SEC football back onto our TV screens. I'm Seth Davis from The Athletic, and this is The Comeback, COVID-19 and the Return of Sports. We will get to Greg Sankey in a minute, but first, a quick roundup on the latest news around the world of sports. First, in the NBA, this week, we're expecting some more clarity on the league's return-to-play scenario. Shams Charania from The Athletic is reporting that the league is polling general managers to get their opinions on what the competition format should look like if and when the league gets back on the court. Some options to consider: resuming the regular season with all 30 teams, bringing back a smaller number of teams to figure out playoff standings, or going straight into a normal 16 playoff with or without a possible play-in tournament. Lots of details still to be ironed out, but in the meantime, more NBA teams are being allowed to open their practice facilities for small workouts, and that is good news. The NHL is also getting closer to allowing its athletes to practice again in team facilities in small groups, but back on the ice. Scott Burnside of The Athletic reports that the NHL has outlined safety protocols that would be required in order for teams to be able to take that step, looking towards a possible timetable of early June to begin those workouts. And finally, in the world of college basketball, Georgetown coach Patrick Ewing revealed late last week that he had been hospitalized for COVID-19. Lots of concern around the sports world for Ewing, but on Monday, his son, Patrick Jr., revealed that his pops is out of the hospital and recovering. We wish Patrick well. And now, my conversation with SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey about his league's announcement that it's allowing athletes back on campus, hopefully with an eye towards getting ready for a fall sports season. Greg Sankey, welcome to the Comeback Podcast. Let's get right to it. Explain to us exactly what the SEC's policy is that you all announced last week, and how did you arrive at the decision to go forward with this set of policies and procedures?
We made an announcement that looks forward to Monday, June 8th as the first day of a no earlier than date for student athletes to return to our athletic department facilities to begin the strength and conditioning part of their preparation this summer. It was a decision made after the NCAA Division I Council allowed voluntary activities to resume effective June 1st, actually. But we have had a medical advisory task force, return to athletic activity task force, looking at a wide array of issues around health concerns, around return to activity, around diagnosis, testing activities that are appropriate, along with our campuses who are for weeks and really months have been planning for the return of their student athletes. So all of those combined to essentially have us, through our presidents and chancellors, allow this opportunity June 8th, which gives a 2-week lead up time for oversight, communication, final preparations, that will lead to the first step of student athletes being active again on our campuses.
Obviously, Greg, nothing is risk-free, especially in this current environment. What can you say about the risk involved in moving ahead with at least these workouts as an introductory phase to getting everybody back on the field and on the court?
We're all learning how to adjust and live in this COVID-19 environment, and nothing in life is risk-free. We know a few realities of our programs. One, they are contained environments. Second, they have built-in sports medicine experts, team doctors, physicians, athletic trainers, sports medicine specialists, and many of them have direct relationships either with university hospitals or with proximal hospitals who deal with health and safety issues every day. And so we have literally the best of the best across our footprint to help guide us in this effort. On the other hand, we have states that are opening. They do this on different timelines, but they're opening to allow physical activity access to gyms. And rather than simply cast everyone to whatever circumstance they may find themselves in, wherever they reside, we believe there's an opportunity to mitigate, manage, oversee the risk, support in a really positive way the health of our student athletes through this initial step of opening our athletic facilities again.
So, Greg, the biggest concern that people have with this, of course, is the big issue of testing. As part of these protocols, you're saying that athletes should get tested on their way onto campus and then once they're on campus, but that doesn't include testing them moving forward once they're on campus unless they are showing symptoms. And as we all know, oftentimes people are asymptomatic for several days until they develop symptoms of the virus, but in the meantime, they can still transmit the virus. This is why, for example, Major League Baseball, their return to play plan, which they released last week, that includes testing all individuals multiple times per week. So what would you say to people who are concerned that that is not adequate and therefore you're running an unacceptable risk that somebody could be asymptomatic, not tested, but positive, and then spread the virus to a whole lot of his teammates?
Well, let's back up in the question and understand just a set of realities. As I indicated, we have relied on health professionals to guide our decision-making, and our campuses will do the same. That's one important point. The second is we have watched decision-making play out in different ways in local communities and across states over the last 60, 70, 80 days of this public health crisis. And so it's really important that we not assume that a set of conference guidelines are actually all that will be done on our campuses. In fact, our campuses are communicating, and that's why the lead-up time is important. They're communicating their preparation and their protocols on a local basis. And so we're not returning to play right now either. We are allowing a limited number of individuals on a voluntary basis to access weight facilities. And we can compare that to the alternative, which is we keep those closed and say to people, go wherever you want to, and relatively speaking, an unsupervised environment without the diagnostic oversight, without the continuity of attention that we'll be providing from a care standpoint on our campuses. So we have to set up what's actually happening against some of the observations about testing being the only way. Again, relying on health professionals, we've made these decisions, and our campuses are absolutely going further than conference guidelines. And we also understand that we've seen in our society the questions about reliability and access to testing. We know that will develop rapidly over the next weeks and months. And so we take a long view as we look at testing, that we're going to learn a great deal, and we're going to be prepared as we go further into the summer to support those protocols on our campuses, even as they're doing that come June 8th and likely before even.
And in fact, your colleague from the Big 12, Bob Bowlsby, the commissioner there, did say recently he's anticipating more and cheaper tests being available in the coming weeks and months. Right now, I've heard these figures, $50 to $100 a test. That's a lot of money that's going to add up. Is it your anticipation, Greg, that as things get moved forward closer to a season potentially starting, that you're going to have more cheaper tests?
Well, there's another word in there that has to be considered, and that's reliability. And we don't have the luxury, based on the information that's been shared with me, to assume that every test result is actually the correct test result. And we're learning collectively more and more about that reality. We invest a great deal in the health and safety support for our student athletes, and we'll do so around testing. Do I expect that availability and the economics will change? I do, but I'm not the one designing those tests. I'm not the one researching the reliability. But I think as we've seen, again, over the last 60, 70 days, particularly over the last 30 days, the availability of testing has increased. The methodology around testing has expanded, and I think we'll see the reliability, which has been a point of concern, be more and more accurate as we move into and through the summer.
The NCAA has declined to issue any specific uniform procedure, so we have variations between schools, variations between conferences. Would it be more helpful for you guys at the conference level if the NCAA had some stronger guidelines so you could ensure that not only was it being done properly, but uniformly across the country?
The NCAA is not alone in not being a national prescriber of protocols. We've seen that from governments at the federal level, states and locales having different expectations and standards. So what I think the NCAA has done is actually acknowledge that reality. I think that's an important anchor in this conversation. As we go through the summer and continue to talk among conference commissioners, my expectations will be more and more common expectations as we go back and think about testing availability and reliability. That will inform decision-making. And we're in a circumstance where we do have time to make some determinations. We get to see the continuing expansion of testing, the enhancement of reliability. Those realities will help inform that decision-making. And candidly, I think the lack of a standard dictate right now at the national level is probably the most informed perspective. Whether it remains that way through the next 60, 70, 80, 90 days, we'll have to see.
In a world of uncertainty, one thing is for sure. Cancer doesn't stop during a global crisis. On Saturday, June 13th, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, LLS, will host a trailblazing event, Big Virtual Climb, sponsored by AbbVie, to support their investment in groundbreaking research to advance blood cancer cures and its first in-class patient education and services, including financial support and clinical trial navigation. Step up to take cancer down by climbing 61 floors or taking 1,762 steps inside or outside, on stairs, on the road, or your treadmill. Climb your way. Join us for an opening ceremony and then take on your climb with our heart-pumping playlist. Join us on June 13th from coast to coast as we come together to climb, conquer, cure. Register at lls.org/bigclimb.
A consistent conversation and debate, frankly, about whether you could have sports on any given campus without the students there, either all of the students or at least, you know, a good percentage of them participating on campus. Can you envision a scenario where you're having sports without students on campus? And could you envision a scenario where you're only having football and not other sports? Or when you talk about fall sports, are you talking about all or nothing?
I have avoided running down the trail of all the hypotheticals because the framing of those if and what if questions narrows whatever reality we may face. And right now in mid-late May, we don't have to make those decisions. We have to think about those realities. We don't have to make those decisions. My fundamental statement has been and will continue to be, our universities have to be back to operations as a first step in fostering the return of sports, football, soccer, volleyball, cross country for us in the fall. And we're seeing that happen literally right now. Our universities are getting back to activity as we learn how to live with the realities around COVID-19. The what ifs, the how does campus look? How do we adjust? What does that mean for students? All of those are to be answered questions. And I've avoided trying to predict because I think we'll have to adjust to the reality. I fully expect, based on the communications from our campuses, adjustments in the fall. So we've seen the adjustments of the academic calendar. I fully expect, like we've seen over the last 5 years, probably for the last decade, an increase in online delivery of courses. But I also expect the emphasis will be on residential learning, whatever that looks like. And those are the plans that are being made that will help us be prepared to answer the question as we move into the fall sports season.
All of us, of course, are under the assumption that, particularly with respect to football, we're talking about no fans in the stadium. It was interesting to read recently, Gene Smith, the athletic director at Ohio State, actually talked about potentially putting fans in their stadium, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, whatever it may be. Has there been, and I realize this is a hypothetical, so obviously you're not going to commit either way, but has there been much conversation about fans in the stadium, or has nobody within the SEC or the conversations you have really willing to go there yet?
Well, sure, there's been conversation. There's been conversation that ranges the gamut. You know, as we look, Seth, at the conversation that's erupted in the narrative, you've seen like football season at one point, I read an article, was going to kick off in July of 2020. Well, I don't know who was talking about that hypothetical. And then there's the notion that, well, it could go all the way to June of 2021 if we kicked off at some point in the spring. And then there's the what happens with fans. So I think all of us are looking at scenarios. But again, it's mid-May. Those are decisions we don't have to make. We have to think forward. We have to think about what does game management look like? What does egress and ingress look like? What does the way we distribute tickets look like? And there are literally hundreds of elements. Part of the value right now in using that time is you're able to watch the last, 7-8 days of NASCAR returning competition. Oh, they don't have fans right now, but they're also creating structures. We have the ability to learn from what's happening literally internationally and domestically and professional leagues as they either return to play or prepare to return to play. And then we have this asset of time that slips by every day that helps us learn how to adapt, how to support what we knew is normal a year ago, and how we prepare for adjustments. I think all of those are better talked about in a full range as opposed to specifying and predicting here's where we're heading.
Greg, last question. I know talking about finances when we're talking about a global health crisis can be awkward, to say the least. So I want to create a little bit of a safe space for you to do just that, because I think we at least have to consider, or at least know, the financial implications if there were no football this year to your conference. Again, I was interested to see Danny White, for example, the athletic director at UCF. He made the argument that it's better to wait until you can put fans fully in the stadium because you're losing a lot of revenue by not having fans in there. What is the financial piece that is staring you in the face? We all know it's never going to overtake the health piece, but what is the financial fact and data point that's kind of staring you in the face that you have to consider as you make all these decisions, because finances are important?
Well, if we look back, we have an opportunity for learning about how we've approached this issue. And that is in the midst of March, with the SEC basketball tournament, we stopped. We didn't have a debate about finances. We looked at the health implications, the realities around the virus, and made a very clear decision. In fact, our conference stopped competition as we continued to learn. We stopped competition completely well before any announcement on March 12th about NCAA championship disruption. And then we've extended it, and obviously, like others, have stopped the season. There are financial implications to a conference that has, for example, arguably the most highly attended, in fact, not arguably, factually, the most highly attended baseball season, the defending national champions. But at the forefront has been a principle that we're going to be attentive to the health and safety. So you look into the fall, and now we're going to play the, well, what if kind of conversation. Well, I don't know what the fall will look like. We have to be open and honest about that reality. We may not know what the late fall looks like or what next spring looks like. And that's where I think some of the ideas about delay are actually operating from the same lack of information that we observe being present here. If we don't play a sport or multiple sports in the fall, are the financial implications? Absolutely. Absolutely. What do those look like? Well, it depends on how the pandemic and the public health realities play out around that decision-making process. And so it's, I think all of us are going through this scenario planning I described, which says, okay, some level of normal, and we're going to have efficiencies that have been introduced because that's a responsibility. And then what if there's partial disruption or complete disruption? I think we all have to be thinking about those contingency plans rather than trying to nail down the specifics. We're going to have to react to the reality.
Greg Sankey, thank you for being on the Comeback Pod. I hope it's only a matter of time before I can make you really angry about how many SEC teams should be in the college football playoff, getting back to those debates once again. But we appreciate your time and all your work on this, and best of luck moving forward.
Yeah, I hope it's multiple, and then that leads us into a conversation about how many teams in the NCAA basketball tournament come spring. So it'll be nice to have those realities again. I appreciate the conversation.
It's a date. Thanks, Greg. Appreciate you.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks to Greg Sankey for joining us today. This is The Comeback presented by The Athletic. Be sure to follow us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you access your podcasts. We're going to be tracking all of these stories, all of these sports, all of these leagues, as they hopefully over the coming weeks and months move back towards getting to the games. Thanks for listening, everybody.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.